Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Labor and Employment Law Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, February 21st, 2017, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's telephone conference call. This afternoon, we will hear a special Courthouse Steps telephone on the oral argument of the Supreme Court case McLean v. EEOC. My name is Laura Flint. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Today, we are happy to have with us Karen Harned, who is Executive Director at the National Federation of Independent Business Small Business Legal Center. I'll turn it over to Karen to get us started. After opening remarks, we'll go to audience question and A. Thank you for speaking with us, Karen. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Lauren. Thanks for everybody joining us today. So the Supreme Court today heard the case of McLean Company versus Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. This is one of the employment law cases on the docket this year, this term, and it concerns the standard of review that appeals courts give to district court decisions when the district court rules on the scope of an EEOC subpoena. And just by way of background, this issue is increasingly important because over the last several years, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, EEOC, has given a huge focus of its work to what it calls the systemic looking for systemic discrimination. So basically, they're really trying to go for the biggest of fish, seeing if they can find disparate treatment of some protective class by a company on a nationwide basis. So when a charge is brought against a particular company, an EEOC charge, sometimes, many times, a lot of the employment bar would argue, the EEOC will use their subpoena powers to go when they're looking into the validity of that charge to, you know, basically go on a fishing expedition to see if they can find and uncover some other types of what they would consider illegal behavior being performed by that company. And so this case really does set up some facts that really kind of speak to that. And in fact, when the case was when McLean put forward their petition for review, they did ask the court to consider two different questions. One was the question that the court ultimately granted cert on, which is whether a district court's decision to quash or enforce an EEOC subpoena gets de novo review or it gets, abuse of discretion type of review, or more of a deferential review. And there is a circuit split, but it's just between the Ninth and everybody else. The Ninth Circuit did say and reviewed this case, which I'll get in the facts in a second, by de novo review, but eight other circuits have had more of an abuse. They've been more deferential, more of an abuse of discretion, more is there a clear, violation of clear error in the law or in fact when reviewing what the district court would have done in their different circuits. McLean had also originally asked for the Ninth Circuit to or the court to weigh in on whether the Ninth Circuit's actions in this case, their decision in this case, upholding, enforcing this EEOC subpoena that they viewed as so broad, really exceeded EEOC's statutory limits of where investigative powers can go under an old Supreme Court decision of EEOC versus Shell Oil. But ultimately, the Supreme Court declined to go to that second question, at least when it took the case. So what the case concerns is McLean Company, which many of you may know, they basically distribute to chain stores all over the you know, country, different things, different items. And they've got a national presence. And Allison Ho, actually a good Federalist Society member, was the attorney for them at the court and did a fine job today. And when they hire a new employee, they give them a physical capability test. They also give this test to current employees that are returning from medical leaves of absence. And so Damiana Ochoa, a woman, was required to take the test before she was allowed to return to work from maternity leave. And over, I think it was the course of a couple months, she took, or at least a few weeks, she took and failed the test 3 times. So as a result, she was not permitted to return to work. And she subsequently filed an administrative charge with the EEOC, and she alleged that the use of the test discriminated against her based on her sex. And so at this point, this is where some of what I just had provided as background came in, because EEOC asked McLean to provide extensive information about the test, including for everybody that took it. And this is also, it should be noted, I think she was in their Arizona facility, but they asked for the subpoena to cover all of the McLean facilities nationwide. And in it, they wanted what is called the pedigree information, which is the subject of the dispute, the underlying dispute here, which is the name, sex, date of birth, social security number, and contact information, personal information of each of the employees, their disability status, the why that person was required to take the test, what their score was, and the reason that they were terminated. And it was really this pedigree information, the names, genders, social security numbers, etc., for each test taker that McLean viewed as too broad. They were willing to provide, you know, information on people nationwide to take that took the test, what their scores were, whether or not they were terminated as a result of those scores. But it was the pedigree information they thought was basically just opening the door unnecessarily for EEOC going beyond the scope of what the charges, underlying charges, concerned. And, you know, the initial charge by Ms. Ochoa was made, EEOC quickly expanded the scope of its investigation to include requests for information that would help it decide if it also wanted to go after an age discrimination claim violation for disparate treatment of workers over the age of 40, even though Ms. Ochoa was not over 40 when she took and failed the test. So that right there, I think, was an indication to the district court that something's going on here beyond just trying to figure out if Ms. Ochoa was discriminated against based on her sex when being given this test. And so, as I mentioned, McLean did go ahead and provide everything but the pedigree information and challenged the subpoena as too broad in the district court and beyond what was relevant to the charges presented. And the district court agreed with McLean and limited the subpoena as a result to, you know, test the going with the test information and who took the test nationwide and what their scores were and who was terminated as a result, but not the pedigree, not their personal information. And the Ninth Circuit decided that they would review the district court's decision de novo, and in so doing, they determined that the subpoena requested by EEOC originally should be enforced, and that McLean should provide the pedigree information. So here we come to the Supreme Court. As I mentioned earlier, the Supreme Court took the case on the issue of what kind of review was to be afforded to district courts. 8 of the circuits say it's more deferential review to what the district courts say. 9th Circuit's on an island and says no, it should be de novo. And the argument today Oh, and the other thing that was interesting is somewhere along the way, EEOC ended up agreeing with McLean on the standard of review and said, we agree with McLean that it should not be de novo, that it should be, you know, if there's a clear violation or of the rule of law or facts, that sort of thing, but abuse of discretion review standard. But we think that the result's the same, that the EEOC subpoena would still be enforced, and the Ninth Circuit got to the right result, even though they used a de novo standard, because because under relevancy, they said that the pedigree information was relevant to their investigation. And so in the end, both the petitioner and the respondent are arguing that the Ninth Circuit does not have de novo review, that it's best for district courts to have more of a deferential review, but they disagree on what that ultimately means. McLean saying that that means the district court got it right and the subpoena should be limited, and the government saying the district court got it wrong and the Ninth Circuit was right to determine that. They just did it under the wrong type of standard of review, but even under, you know, abuse of discretion, they would have gotten to the right place. So as a result, they the Supreme Court had to get an appointed attorney, and I'm sorry I'm missing his first name, but his last name is Kennard, and he did a very nice job arguing for de novo review, ultimately, on behalf of the court. Though, now that I'm getting into the oral argument and how that went, there was just a lot of, I think ultimately the justices seemed, I don't know. There didn't seem to be much discussion about how deferential the review needed to be. I mean, de novo versus deferential. It was more getting into the discussion was actually more into, you know, the relevance of the subpoena requests and that that were asked of the EEOC and the pedigree information. There was more discussion about that than the standard of review. There was a little at the, initially when Allison was up there, there was discussion of, you know, is the district court the best to determine this? And I thought she answered that ably. But then they really quickly launched into the relevancy argument and whether or not the pedigree information was relevant and what the standard is on determining that. And that really was, I think, Breyer was the most interesting when we were talking about relevancy, because he did seem to understand that what the EEOC was asking for, you know, was giving them much broader authority. And Allison Ho did a nice job of reminding him of the Shell Oil standard and that it has to be, you know, relevant to the charge. But it looked like he was wanting a clear definition of what's in between the two. And, you know, what's the in between, you know, unbounded authority of EEOC getting to say, well, everything's relevant, because, you know, once you start going down one trail of, everybody has to take a test. Well, what does that mean for disabled people, even though the facts in this case concerned a woman that was under the age of 40 and it was a gender discrimination case? So he did seem to understand and appreciate that, and really, I thought, was positive in that regard. But ultimately, you know, when Mr. Kennard got up there and there really wasn't a lot of questioning of him, I just felt like the justices, it's going to be much easier for them just to stick with the question presented, stick with whether or not de novo review is appropriate, or if it needs to be a more deferential standard. And really the only one arguing for, aggressively, I think, on the Standard piece was Ginsburg, who seemed to question whether the district court really had that much of a bird's eye view more than, or a boots on the ground view more than an appeals court when it comes to these questions. You know, McLean's counsel, Allison, you know, said that the district courts are seeing the facts up close. The appeals courts are not, but then Justice Ginsburg seemed to push back on that a little bit. In this particular case, Allison was able to say that the facts were very apparent because, as I had mentioned, McLean was also being investigated by EEOC as a result of this charge for potential disability claim violations and age violations. And so the district court had seen all of that color, but Allison made the point that it doesn't matter whether or not that's the case in every case that the district court gets. The district court is still going to be looking at the case and seeing the facts and the context more than of the case, more than an appeals court ever would. And it just didn't seem like she got much pushback, if any, beyond Ginsburg on that point. And then when you have the government coming in right behind her saying, we agree, and by the way, if you like the Ninth Circuit's decision here that EEOC basically gets to troll for any information that it wants, we can still get there on this deferential standard. So I might be wrong, but I find it a really tough row for the court-appointed counsel, Mr. Kennard. Through his creative arguments, he used Administrative Procedures Act, saying that that did not allow for a deferential standard. And I thought that was one of his best arguments. But I didn't get the sense that there were a lot of takers on that on the panel of justices. And when it comes to the issue that a lot of us ultimately want to get cabined, you know, the subpoena power of the EEOC, I'm just not sure the justices are going to do it. It's just going to depend. You know, Breyer did seem open to it. Kennedy is not always wonderful on employment law issues. And given the fact that it's a 4-4 split, unless there's a clear, you know, majority there, it's going to be so much easier for them just to have a nice, you know, at a minimum 7-1, if not 8-0 decision on standard review, ultimately on this case. With that, I guess I can take questions, and I know it's a little complicated, so if people have, you know, need clarification, I'm happy to provide that as well.
Let's go to audience questions. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt indicating that the floor mode has been turned on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key. When we get to your request, you will hear a prompt, and then you may ask your question. We'll answer questions in the order in which they are received. Not seeing any questions right now, I wanted to ask a couple myself. Karen, do you think this case will have quick turnaround in the decision, or do you think we'll have to wait until later in the term?
If it goes the way I suspect, where they just stick with what's the standard of review appellate courts give to district court opinions on EEOC subpoenas, then I think it'll go – I just don't see how it's going to take that long. I mean, somebody's obviously going to write the opinion, but I don't see that there's going to be a lot of disagreement on that. Again, maybe Ginsburg disagrees, but other than that, and I guess – potentially Sotomayor would join her, but I don't see a lot of disagreement on that core question. Maybe I'm wrong. And so as a result, I could see it happening quicker. If they decide to go broader, then maybe it could extend several months, but I just think the odds of that happening are pretty low. So, you know, who knows, this could be something that could get turned around in a matter of, you know, 6 to 8 weeks. We'll just have to see, but it could definitely go quick.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. I'll make a brief announcement. Our next Teleform conference call is scheduled for tomorrow, Wednesday, February 22nd at 2:30. Please note the special start time of 2:30 instead of 2. That call will be a preview of the Supreme Court case, Packingham versus North Carolina. The call will feature Jonathan Sherman, partner at Boies, Schiller & Flexner, and Melissa Arbus-Sherry from Latham & Watkins. A reminder to keep an eye out for emails announcing upcoming teleforums, and you can also consult the full schedule of our upcoming teleform conference calls on the Federalist Society's website, fedsoc.org. Also available there are podcasts of previously recorded teleform calls you may have missed. I'll make another call for questions. To ask one, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. In the meantime, Karen, so you said you think the court will side for the petitioner in this case?
I do. I think that the arguments for a district court, deference to the district court, are just too strong, especially in light of the statutory objectives of Title VII in particular. You know, actually the government was very effective on this point in their briefing for deferential review of district court decisions, and that is, if there's de novo review by the appellate courts, that's going to lead to that could lead to a significant delay of getting these cases resolved. And with Title VII built throughout that law are many structural things that are trying to get to a final resolution as fast as possible. You don't want in a workplace these issues hanging out there. You definitely don't want it for the people that are victims, right? If there's discrimination, you want that handled sooner rather than later. That's a very much a policy objective that is throughout Title VII. And so if you're now giving appeals courts the chance to, review de novo everything, it could just really elongate the process, which is why I think the EEOC even, you know, agreed with the petitioners on that point ultimately.
Again, to ask a question, please enter star, then the pound key on your telephone keypad. Not seeing any questions. Do you have any closing remarks you'd like to make, Karen?
No, I think that's it. I mean, it's an interesting case for employment lawyers, especially those that practice with the EEOC. But this case, sadly, is one of, I think, many this term that for the average person is probably not the most burning questions that they have and want the Supreme Court to decide. But I think that's what you get with an eight-member court.
Thank you so much. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our expert today for the benefit of her valuable time and expertise. We welcome listener feedback by email at info@fedsoc.org. Thank you all for joining us. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.